Hello, 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 and welcome back, or welcome for the very first time, to Infectious, your favorite podcast all about the little itty-bitty critters that make us sick, how they do it, and oh, so much more. My name is Adriana Piero, and I'll be your host for this little journey. I'll say a very early apology for the extensive time in between episodes. I tried to use the summer to relax and refresh myself after a year of fighting COVID-19, so I hope you all can forgive me for taking a well-needed break. But welcome back and welcome to a wonderful fall episode. You must be wondering what deep dive we'll be touching on today, and boy, do I have a treat for you. Campylobacteriosis. And I know you might be thinking to yourself, Campylohooey? But Campylobacter might just be one of the most prolific bacteria that you've never heard about. So sit down, plug in, and get ready for an episode wrapped up in geese poop, reasons why you really need to stop washing your chicken breasts before cooking them, new excuses to never do an obstacle course with your friends, and so much more. So let's get into it for episode 3, Campylobacteriosis. So let's start at the very beginning. What is campylobacteriosis and what causes it? Campylobacteriosis, or Campylobacter infection, is caused by the Campylobacter bacteria and is recognized as the leading cause of bacterial foodborne illness around the globe. Each year, this tiny microbe results in more disease globally than its much more well-known friends Salmonella, Shigella, and E. coli combined. The Campylobacter species of bacteria, though, is diverse, and while closely related genetically, can both act as pathogens, something that makes us sick, and commensals, things that live with humans and provide mutual benefit. Among the vast array of Campylobacter species, there are some primary human pathogens, including C. jejuni, C. coli, C. lari, C. fetus, C. upsaliensis, and C. hyointestinalis. C. fetus, the type species of the genus, is a common cause of abortion and infectious infertility among sheep and cattle, while rarely causing disease in humans. In contrast, the most common species implicated in human infection is C. jejuni and C. coli. These two species are implicated as the causative agent of between 80 to 90% and 5 to 10% of all human Campylobacter cases, respectively. Increasingly, though, C. upsaliensis is now being accepted as an important cause of diarrheal disease as well, but this one is particularly in young children. If we took a page from the magic school bus and shrunk ourselves down to 5 micrometers in size, we would be about the same height as a Campylobacter bacteria. For reference, that would be like shrinking down a 6-foot man to about 1/1,000,000th of his size. Standing there, or probably more likely swimming around in the gastrointestinal tract of a bird, if you were to look at a bacteria of the Campylobacter genera, you would observe a gram-negative bacteria that was either a comma or S-shape, with bipolar flagella displaying a characteristic darting movement. This beautiful, curvaceous shape is what provided the bacteria its name, derived from the Greek campylos, meaning curved, and bactron, meaning rod. Put these two pieces together and you have a curved rod, the perfect description of the morphology of Campy. This species of bacteria is known to be exceptionally difficult to grow in laboratories. But why? Well, as I had just mentioned, the bacteria is well adapted to its existence as a symbiote in the gut of warm-blooded birds and mammals. Therefore, C. jejuni is a capnophilic and microaerophilic subspecies with optimal growth temperatures varying from 37 degrees Celsius to 42 degrees Celsius. To break that down, capnophilic, derived from the ancient Greek words capno, meaning smoke, and philia, often translated to mean the highest form of love, indicates that the bacteria will thrive in an environment enriched with carbon dioxide, while microaerophilic indicates that they require between 5 to 10% ambient oxygen and will not grow in atmospheric oxygen, which is approximately 20% at sea level. They're actually so choosy about this that some Campylobacter species, including C. jejuni, will transform from being a wonderful comma to a cockle shape, think a circular little ball of bacterial goodness, when exposed to atmospheric oxygen. Hearing about this distinct transition, I was left with the question, and I'm sure you are right now as well, what's driving the bacteria to change its shape? Is it to protect itself? A stress response? Is she just not ready for the party and needs to change her outfit again because she decided that her shirt is too sparkly? Like, what's up? So apparently, the transition of bacteria from their traditional, in this case comma or S shape, to a coccoidal form isn't unique to Campy. Rather, it has been indicated in other bacterial species as an adaptive response to certain conditions, such as nutrients deficiency, elevated temperature, and other stress factors. In both Campylobacter and Helicobacter pylori publications, it has been suggested that this transition is degenerative in nature, and by definition, makes the bacteria transition from being a disease-causing baddie to, well, a blob. But see, while most frequently Campylobacter will appear as a curved rod, this species has been observed in a variety of other forms, including bacterial filaments, donuts, and the coccoid form that I just mentioned. As a quick aside, although bacteria are normally depicted as pill-like or ball shapes, they actually have an amazing diversity in both shape and form. This could include being little balls of bacterial goodness, known as cocci, short and stubby or long pill shapes, referred to as coccobacillus and bacillus, little comma shapes, known as vibrios, gradual spirals, which are spirillium, or full-out corkscrews, which are often referred to as spirochetes. As well, while most of us think of bacteria as individual entities that like to hang out all by themselves, some will have partners, which would be referred to as the added abbreviation diplo to the beginning of any of those shape names, or will also show up as filamentous forms, where many bacteria join together like the Avengers to generate a long strand resembling a strand of hair. These strands can then interlock with one another to form a mesh, like that horrible hair clog you pulled out of your drain this weekend. It's important to note that all of these different shapes and forms function with a different purpose. They in some way help the bacteria survive, which is why they were evolved. Just like how a giraffe has a long neck in order to be able to eat food that's up high. So, let's bring us back to Campy and talk about the morphologies we see in it. Each of these unique Campylobacter morphologies have been associated with different stages of bacterial growth. So, while growing exponentially, after being added to a new medium, Campylobacter will appear in a rod-like form that will then transition to either the coccoid or filamentous morphology as the nutrients is depleted, and finally, they will morph into a wonderful donut shape as the nutrients is fully depleted and they begin to transition into their coccoid form. This morphological change from rod to donut to coccoid seems to be driven by a change in the makeup of the cell wall, the organelle equivalent to a human skin, mouth, and anus combined. While growing and replicating, bacterium cell walls are traditionally quite active, facilitating the entrance and exit of nutrients and waste. Modifications of the cell wall that reduce its leakiness occur during this morphological transition, indicating that the bacterium may be entering a protective state. Literature on this topic have shown that the coccoid forms are thought to be viable but not culturable, suggesting that they can't replicate to make more bacterial babies. So you might ask, why would a bacteria just, well, end its life cycle? And it seems this might have a linkage to biofilm formation, a very important component to their survival. Biofilms are most easily described as the plaque on your teeth, and are a protective little community where sacrificial bacteria on the outside bond together with calcium and other sediments to protect dormant bacteria within. This little protective shell helps the dormant interior bacteria survive harsh environments that would normally kill them, while the external members that are part of the outside wall sacrifice themselves for the others, almost like a Trojan horse. If a Trojan horse was made out of the bodies of your fallen comrades. This allows the internal bacteria to be released out of basically a Pandora's box of bacterial goodness to wreak havoc when the surrounding atmosphere is right. A little bit later in this podcast, I'll come back to the microbiological components of Campylobacter to explain how it's so good at evading the human immune system and causing disease. But for now, let's actually learn a little bit about Campylobacteriosis and what the infection looks like and how it manifests in the human body. Campylobacter infection normally occurs 2 to 5 days, although an extensive range would be 1 to 10 days, after consuming something that is contaminated with the bacteria. And yes, that's right, 1 to 10 days, which means that no, if you're sick on Monday, it's not because of the sushi from that dingy place downstairs you ate on Sunday, but is more likely from something that you ate up to a week and a half ago. In addition, the amount of bacteria you have to consume is surprisingly low, with studies reporting that 50% of human subjects became infected after consuming between 1,000 to 100,000 bacteria, depending on the subspecies. That's the amount that can be found in just a drop of raw chicken juice. The combination of a very small necessary dose to cause infection and the long incubation period is one of the reasons it can be hard for epidemiologists to investigate foodborne outbreaks and pinpoint what food or water source is contaminated. And if you don't believe me, try to list every single thing you've eaten in the last 1 to 10 days. Then consider that some of that could have been contaminated without you even knowing. Yikes. Campylobacter is a tad bit of a simpler disease than others you may encounter and manifests as your bread and butter gastrointestinal illness. And yes, that means diarrhea and vomiting. Thankfully, it is normally acute, typically lasting only 3 to 6 days, although occasionally symptoms may last much longer. Campylobacteriosis usually involves diarrhea, often bloody, fever, and stomach cramps. Nausea and vomiting may also accompany the diarrhea. In addition, other symptoms may include headaches and muscle pain. But still, there are others who are luckier and are asymptomatic, although they are still able to pass the disease to others. So, while it's not a problem for them, they might just be spreading it around to those they love. Asymptomatic carriage is difficult to estimate, but it is believed to vary based on age and underlying health status. Some good news amidst all the doom and gloom. Death from Campylobacter is quite rare, but unfortunately, it does occur. Fatalities are usually confined to the very young, under the age of 2, elderly patients, or those who are immunocompromised. But on the note of more serious complications and sequelae, Campylobacter has many, which greatly magnify the overall morbidity of the infection. Acute complications may include bacteremia, hepatitis, pancreatitis, and miscarriage, while post-infection complications can vary widely and may include neurological, gastrointestinal, and rheumatological manifestations. So let's explore these in deeper detail, starting with serious complications. Among cases infected with C. jejuni, the most common intero-invasive Campylobacter species, bacteremia occurs in less than 1% of cases. Good news for all of us. Bacteremia is the presence of bacteria in the blood, and therefore is a microbiological finding. In contrast, you might be more inclined to the term sepsis, or septic shock, which is the clinical diagnosis that specifies an infection and the etiological source. While septicemia can occur in all cases, it is most common amongst those who are immunocompromised, such as those living with HIV, or those with other comorbidities, including malignancies, cancers, and liver disease. This is because Campylobacter, like most infections, can more easily invade individuals and cause severe illness amongst those with compromised immunity. Next, we'll speak about spontaneous abortion. While I know that all our foodborne illnesses can cause miscarriages, some of the reasons why it's suggested that women do not consume sushi, a potential source of mercury, bacteria, and parasites, and luncheon meats, due to the risk of listeria. I hadn't previously heard of Campylobacter presenting a significant risk to pregnant women and the developing fetus. I want to start by saying that C. jejunae infection during pregnancies are generally mild and self-limiting, similar to the regular disease in others non-immunocompromised individuals. So no, you do not need to burn all the chicken in your house right now because of fear of foodborne illness while pregnant, although I would suggest getting a food thermometer, but we'll touch on that in the prevention section later. But an infection still may have some serious consequences for the fetus if it induces maternal bacteremia. C. jejunae, when present in maternal blood, can be transmitted to the fetus in utero or to the newborn infant during or shortly after the birthing process. And this shows in the little cuddle nuggets as having diarrhea and/or bacteremia, but generally, these neonatal C. jejunae infections are benign and have little long-term effects, excluding some recent studies that indicate some stunting of a child's growth. Unfortunately, though, if the maternal bacteremia is severe during pregnancy, it can induce spontaneous abortions, stillbirths, or early neonatal deaths, although it is rarely associated with maternal death. Studies examining the capacity for Campylobacter species to pass across the placental barrier have found that when C. jejunae was inoculated on the maternal side of an organ culture of human chorioamniotic membranes,
this is the tissue layer between the maternal vascular system and the fetal vascular system that allows for the exchange of nutrients from the mother to the child,
C. jejunae was able to penetrate to the fetal side of the culture. Interestingly, there is a recorded case of transmission of C. jejunae across a hospital maternity ward, with the common source indicated as an infected asymptomatic caretaking physician. Overall, though, incidence of severe disease is once again rare, so likely isn't a major concern for the majority of us. And now, let's explore the sequelae. One very cool and interesting component of infection with Campylobacter is its interaction with the human immune system, and this results in its capacity to rarely cause hyperreactivity that manifests as post-infectious sequelae. This can result in reactive arthritis, Guillain-Barré syndrome,
I promise you'll understand that very soon,
and even gastrointestinal manifestations, such as post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome. First, touching on reactive arthritis. Campylobacter is one of several bacterial enteropathogens associated with reactive arthritis, a post-infectious sterile inflammation of joints and tissues that, in a significant proportion of cases, can be long-lasting with significant associated morbidity. Reactive arthritis is estimated to occur in between 0.7 to 8.5% of C. jejunae enteritis cases and leads to the impaired movement of various joints. It is a non-purulent,
a fun way to say non-pussy,
inflammation, which can be triggered by infections in either the gut or urogenital tract. Think urinary tract infections. While reactive arthritis is generally limited to the destruction of bone, cartilage, and joints through continuous inflammation, Campylobacteriosis has also been associated with additional musculoskeletal symptoms such as tendinitis, enthesopathy, or buritis. Tendinitis is the inflammation of a tendon, most commonly associated with overuse, and the most common one that many of you will think about is tennis elbow. In contrast, enthesopathy is an issue with the attachment of a tendon ligament or component to a bone, which can make it difficult to move the affected joint or area of the body. And finally, buritis is a painful condition that affects the small fluid-filled sacs,
called burae,
in your joints. This inflammation occurs more commonly in the shoulders, elbows, or hips, and often occurs due to repetitive motion. While the exact causative mechanism is still unknown, researchers hypothesize that reactive arthritis is an autoimmune disorder. Studies have shown that the initial bacterial pieces, or products, travel from the primary site of infection, in this case, normally the gastrointestinal tract, through the body to the tissue lining the joints. What happens next isn't wholly understood, but in other bacteria, namely chlamydia, these bacteria are viable, although in an abhorrent state. Next, we'll touch on Guillain-Barré syndrome. Campylobacter is also the most common infection associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome, a disorder in which the body's immune system attacks the peripheral nerve cells, causing an acute, ascending, flaccid paralysis, a process initiated by anti-ganglioside antibodies directed to the Campylobacter infection. While exceptionally rare, affecting only 1 in 100,000 individuals per year, it results from an individual's own immune system damaging the nerves of the body, resulting in muscle weakness and, in extreme cases, paralysis. Guillain-Barré syndrome is able to cause symptoms that last a few weeks to several years, and while most people recover fully, some have permanent nerve damage. Rarely, people have also died from this complication. Individuals affected by Guillain-Barré syndrome usually first experience a tingling sensation in both legs that often spreads to the arms and upper body. These symptoms may increase until some muscles cannot be used at all, and in the most severe of cases, the person may become paralyzed. These symptoms can progress over hours, days, or weeks, with the weakness experienced by the case normally peaking within 4 weeks of initial symptoms appearing. As quickly as the disease developed, the patient can recover, with recovery spanning from as little as a few weeks to as long as a few years. While several things are known to trigger Guillain-Barré syndrome, prior infection with Campylobacter jejuni is the most common causative agent, and is identified in approximately 1/3 of cases with this autoimmune disease. In response to the infectious disease, the body's immune system generates antibodies that cross-react with gangliosides, triggers attached to the outer membrane of our nerve cells. This autoimmune response results in damage to the nerves and creates a functional blockade of nerve conduction. Before we even go any further, you might just be listening and thinking to yourself,
ganglio, what's it?
A ganglioside is a component of a nerve cell and is found on the surface of a variety known as ganglia, present in our brains. Made of a combination of fat and sugar, these molecules are essential for the ability for ganglia to create the electric potential needed to transfer information through the brain and throughout the body. Therefore, when antibodies bind and cause destruction of these cell types, it can disrupt the signaling, resulting in the symptoms of Guillain-Barré syndrome. It is important to note, though, that Guillain-Barré syndrome is rare because it necessitates a perfect combination of host and agent. First, the host or infected individual must have an inherent genetic susceptibility, in which the current understanding is limited, but appears to be dependent on the combination of genetic loci functioning in tandem to create a susceptible host. Secondly, individuals must be infected with a strain of C. jejuni that both causes severe disease and has a ganglioside-mimicking carbohydrate on the surface. To note, the synthesis of these ganglioside-mimicking carbohydrates depends on a polymorphic gene, meaning a gene with many different variants, in addition to a set of enzymes that varies greatly across strains. Therefore, these combinations of factors must align perfectly and can largely explain the rareness of this reaction. And finally, we'll wrap up this section by talking about the final category of sequelae associated with CAMPY, chronic gastrointestinal outcomes. A recent review identified strong correlations between a prior Campylobacter infection and irritable bowel syndrome, functional dyspepsia, inflammatory bowel disease, and celiac disease, highlighting the significant cost and impact on quality of life measures associated with this pathogen. A fact that I found super interesting when I read it was the quote, "Infectious gastroenteritis is the best characterized environmental risk factor for the development of irritable bowel syndrome." Specifically, studies have reported that up to 36% of those with acute campylobacteriosis develop IBS in the 1 to 2 years after illness. This is pretty shocking, as that means that upper estimates suggest that 1 in 3 people who have had any infectious diarrhea or upset stomach may develop some type of IBS. And interestingly, post-Campylobacter IBS appears to be of the diarrhea-predominant phenotype, although changing phenotypes over time have been observed. As well, there appears to be an association between the severity of the initial acute illness and the risk of IBS later on. For example, following a waterborne outbreak of Campylobacter and enterohemorrhagic Escherichia coli, Marshall et al. Reported an increased risk of IBS amongst those with a longer duration of diarrhea, dysentery, and abdominal cramps during the illness. As a quick aside on IBS, well, according to point prevalence estimates, 12 to 30% of you will know exactly what I'm talking about when I mention irritable bowel syndrome, I thought a helpful aside would be good to add here. IBS is a common disorder that affects the large intestine. Signs and symptoms include cramping, abdominal pain, bloating, gas, and diarrhea or constipation, or both. IBS is a chronic condition that you'll need to manage long-term and is often diagnosed in tandem with additional disorders such as anxiety and depression. While the correlation between these disorders isn't largely understood, there is some belief that the stress of IBS may increase the risk of mental health disorders. Also,
as a much cooler hypothesis,
there is strong evidence that suggests that our gut's microbiota has an important role in bidirectional interactions between the gut and the nervous system. Some studies suggest that our gut interacts with our central nervous system by regulating brain chemistry and influencing neuroendocrine systems, meaning that our gut may play an important role in helping us regulate our stress response, manage our anxiety, and even impact our memory's function. Super cool. But anyways, back to Campy. Our understanding of the pathogenesis between Campylobacter and IBS is still evolving. Studies of post-Campylobacter IBS have identified increased white blood cells in the epithelium and upregulated cytokines in the rectal mucosa of patients with Campylobacter-attributed post-infectious IBS. Intestinal inflammation is also accompanied by increased intestinal permeability, which may lead to increased sensitivity to food products and immune activation. And these findings, taken all together, suggest that C. jejuni can breach the intestinal barrier, may prime the intestines for chronic inflammatory responses in susceptible individuals, and may play a role in triggering IBS after campylobacteriosis. And that's all I've got for the symptoms and sequelae of the disease. As you can see, while it is normally not that serious, Campy, just like your friend who promised they'd only sleep on your couch for a week and now has been there for 3 months, is in it for the long term for many people. Now that we know what we can expect after contracting the bacteria, how exactly does such a tiny little organism actually manage to make us sick? Adhesion, invasion, toxin production, and subversion of host cell processes are themes common in the virulence machinery of many enteric prokaryotic pathogens. Unfortunately, our understanding of the major mechanisms that allow Campy to actually cause disease in humans is relatively limited compared to its enteric brethren. This is believed to be due to three factors, including that Campylobacter is an extremely challenging organism to work with in the lab, that it has high levels of interstrain variability in virulence factors, and there's a lack of effective animal models for human enteric infections. All of these challenges combined have made it difficult for scientists to examine how removing or adding virulence factors may alter the bacteria's ability to cause disease, or even just figure out what tools the bacteria uses to evade our immune systems. But regardless, we like to keep it positive over here, so let's focus on the things that we do know about this pathogen, because there is quite a bit. After ingestion of campylobacters, colonization of the mucus blanket and adhesion to the intestinal cell surface occurs. While how this occurs isn't exactly understood, C. jejuni has been shown within human chorionic epithelial cells taken both from the infected humans and macaque monkeys. In addition, similar cell invasions have been seen in a variety of cell lines. Although some isolates of C. jejuni are highly invasive in these experimental models, many isolates show low levels of host cell entry in vitro, where in vitro refers to in laboratory rather than in living models. Rather than entering directly into the apical cells in the GI tract,
It is now believed that C. jejuni preferentially enters polarized epithelial cells via the basolateral membrane.
Breaking down the technical jargon, in the large intestine, the apical, or most outside surface near all the food that is being digested, functions to absorb that nutrients, while the layer underneath, called the basolateral surface, functions to export the yummy nutrients into your bloodstream so it can be used by your body. And these cells, hidden underneath the surface, are the ones that current evidence suggests our friend Campylobacter is able to enter. How exactly Campylobacter invades the cells is pretty cool. Similar to other invasive pathogens, C. jejuni has been shown to be one of just a handful of bacteria that are able to subvert host cytoskeletal structures to not only enter the cell, but also trick the cell to transport the bacteria around the inside. This is accomplished through taking advantage of the microtubules of the cell.
Think of this as almost an invisible internal scaffolding in your cells that give it shape.
And creating proteins that trick the cell to modify these scaffolds to allow the bacteria to hang out and move around the inside. There has even been some studies that show that Campy is able to move between cells through these intracellular tunnels known as tight junctions, which is pretty darn cool. Campy's amazing invasion is accomplished through a number of mechanisms that help to improve C. jejuni's virulence, or ability to make us sick. This includes cell adhesion molecules, cytolethal distending toxin, also known as CDT, lipopolysaccharides, antimicrobial efflux pumps, capsular polysaccharides, invasion proteins, flagella, and an oak-like oscillation, and a type 6 secretion system that has been recently discovered in some C. jejuni strains. And yes, I know that sounds like absolute gibberish, so sit back and relax as I explain a few of these. One of these major C. jejuni virulence factors is one you've probably heard of before, flagella. As I mentioned earlier when describing the appearance of Campy, C. jejuni cells express bipolar flagella that promote cellular motility. Bipolar flagella are present at both the top and the bottom of the bacteria, so you can think of them as a combination of a fabulous ponytail and tail that the bacteria swings back and forth to move. But the flagella's role isn't just motility. Rather, these tiny little flippers help the bacteria's first stage of attack. This means the flagella functions to support the very first step of Campy binding to the host cell to begin its entrance. How this was discovered is actually pretty cool, as Campylobacter that have been genetically modified to be afflagellated show a major reduction in their ability to enter host cells in vitro. This provided strong evidence of their importance in the ability for the organism to colonize the gastrointestinal tract. Additionally, C. jejuni flagellum is relatively unique compared to other bacteria, as that it's not recognized by human or chicken toll-like receptor 5, with or without O-glycosylation, even though toll-like receptor 5 is known to recognize flagellins from other bacteria to initiate and promote immune response. Therefore, the antigenic C. jejuni flagellum utilizes multiple mechanisms to evade the immune system. In addition to the flagella, Campylobacter's capsular polysaccharides function as an essential tool in its assault on our bodies. I always like to think of polysaccharide capsules as disguises that bacteria wear so immune cells can't detect them. Using a very traditional description of the immune systems as cops and robbers movies, the capsule of polysaccharides that C. jejuni wraps herself in would be comparable to the robbers changing outfits as they escape the scene or switching vehicles so they can't be detected. Except, in the bacteria's case, this disguise would be a big, cushy jacket of something very similar in consistency to snot. The bacteria's capsule represents a key antigenic determinant, meaning that it is used by our bodies to detect the bacteria when it enters to fight it off. As well, the capsule has been shown to promote resistance to complement-mediated cell death by normal human serum, which would be best equated to functioning as a bulletproof vest from the body's immune system. Importantly, C. jejuni that had the capsule artificially removed through mutations are shown to cause less severe disease in a ferret model of diarrheal disease and nearly completely attenuated disease in a Galleria melanella model. The capsule is believed to be one of many bacterial structures that influences Campy's ability to bind and enter the host cell, similar to the flagella. which identifies this capsule as not only Campylobacter's shield from detection and destruction, but also one of its many useful keys to entering our bodies and causing disease. The next component of Campy that I'll touch on that makes it a decisive foe is something known as phase variable modifications, a characteristic that plays a key role in the mechanisms of CPS pathogenesis and immune evasion. This one is a bit more complicated, but is related to the capsule because, well, it's the modifications of what the capsule is made of. In the simplest terms, phase variable modifications occurs when the bacteria uses a subset of genes to produce a gene product. By changing the number of sugars included in the recipe from, let's say, 5 to 3, the shorter sugar will look different to the immune system and prevents C. jejuni from being detected. A great equivalency is when one of your friends goes from having hair down to their butt and one day just cuts it all off and gets a pixie cut. People who know them really well might recognize them from smaller details, but someone who's more of an acquaintance might not be able to tell who they are at all. Therefore, this phase variation acts to allow Campylobacter to switch up their disguise, helping them survive in the human body and cause even more damage. After using all of these tools to enter the intestinal cells, Campylobacter is able to disrupt the normal absorptive functions, resulting in the main symptom we observe, diarrhea. This is thought to occur directly due to the entrance of the bacteria into the cells and excretion of toxins, no worries, that's up next, as well as indirectly, after the initiation of an inflammatory response. Campylobacter's toxin, known as cytolethal distending toxin, is the only toxin identified to date attributed to C. jejuni. CDT is a 3-part protein toxin that functions by being injected into the cell and causing cytodistension and cell cycle arrest in the G2 or M phase in epithelial cells. In addition, it also causes cell arrest in T lymphocytes. While it's not entirely clear the role this plays, it is believed to contribute more to immunomodulation and invasiveness rather than directly inducing diarrhea. Considering all of these different components of Campylobacter, the clinical presentation of campylobacteriosis is really dependent on how many factors are present. This includes possible variations in the various virulence factors amongst Campylobacter infecting the individual, and also the extent and nature of the host response, which will determine the extent of damage to the intestinal epithelium and resulting diarrhea. Good thing, though, while your first challenge with a strain of Campylobacter may make you very sick, studies have shown that continuous challenges with the same strain leads to progressive immunity and milder symptoms with each infection. Now that we have a good sense of the bacteria, how it makes us sick, as well as what the disease looks like, let's touch on the epidemiology. Where can we find the disease? How does the risk of me getting Campylobacter change over time and place, and even more fun, where do I get this disease from? The Campylobacter species of bacteria has a wide global distribution. This can be attributed to their ability to function as both commensals with domesticated and wild animals, in addition to being effective pathogens. This characteristic makes them one of the leading zoonoses and anthraponoses, also referred to as reverse zoonoses. You might be asking, what exactly is a zoonosis and what is an anthraponosis? And no worries, it's a pretty specific term. Zoonosis is a categorization given to infectious diseases that are able to jump from animals to humans. In contrast, anthraponoses are infections that can be passed from humans to animals, so basically vice versa. Campylobacter being a combination of these two means that a chicken can pass it to a goose who can poop in a river and pass it to a human who can poop in a toilet and pass it to their dog when they try to drink out of it. And on and on and on it goes. Thankfully, Campylobacteriosis is predominantly associated with foodborne outbreaks, contaminated water, and uncooked meats, specifically poultry and raw milk. However, there are some very interesting other sources, but you'll have to stick with me through some statistics before hearing about the weird and wonderful reservoirs and risk factors for the infection. Campylobacter is a disease that packs a global punch. Recent estimates by the Global Burden of Disease suggest that Campylobacter infection is associated with 7.5 million disability-adjusted life years globally, second only to rotavirus as a causative agent of diarrheal disease, with varying epidemiology across multiple populations. Disability-adjusted life years are used in epidemiology to measure the number of years of life lost due to ill health, disability, or death. Has become a popular way to create numbers able to measure the impact of diseases, as mortality alone does not give a complete picture of the burden of disease that affects individuals in different countries. For example, while having a shark eat my arm doesn't kill me, there is a lifelong cost to that, something captured in dallies, but definitely not in mortality. Therefore, you can kind of think of a DALY as a measure of exactly how many years of life that person doesn't get to thoroughly enjoy due to time lived in a state of less than total health. This allows us to compare diseases that kill, such as measles, to those that maim, such as obesity or cataracts, causing blindness. While Campylobacter infection occurs around the world, there are distinct differences in the epidemiology of the infection when comparing high and lower-income countries. For this reason, I will describe the rest of the epidemiology by dividing my description into these two sections. While infection with Campylobacter occurs globally, the overwhelming burden is found in the developing world. In these nations, Campylobacter is almost a universal cause of early childhood diarrhea, with between 40 to 60% of children under the age of 5 developing at least one symptomatic infection. Risk factors in these regions would include children living in rural settings where interactions with chicken feces, contaminated water, and consuming unpasteurized milk are common exposures. Unfortunately, though, Campylobacter is not only a disease that injures us. It also kills many every single year. The 2015 Global Burden of Disease estimates indicate over 25,000 deaths annually in children under 5 years of age, with the highest rates in parts of Africa and Asia. For some context, because I never like to think of these deaths as just numbers, that would be the same thing as losing 52 elementary schools of children in Canada or the USA each year following infection with Campylobacter. In addition to the morbidity associated with acute diarrheal illness in these populations, Campylobacter infection has been shown to make it harder for kids to grow. This includes being associated with a decrease in children's height and weight, even amongst those that experience asymptomatic infections. Children from the malnutrition and enteric disease cohort study, better known as the MAL-ED study, who were colonized by Campylobacter experienced approximately a 1 centimeter growth shortfall and an approximate 0.25 kilogram decrease in weight gain as compared to children without Campylobacter infection, an effect that appears to be more pronounced at 0 to 2 months of age. While the greatest burden of disease is in the developing world, acute enteric infections are also a frequent cause for outpatient visits and hospitalizations throughout the developed world. For example, in Western Europe, Canada, and the United States, Campylobacter is one of the most common causes of travel-related diarrhea. As well, for domestically acquired diseases, Campylobacteriosis is largely associated with the consumption of contaminated food and drink. In these settings, Campylobacteriosis is most common in young children under the age of 5, men, this one is thought to be due to reduced food safety habits in this population, and the elderly. In 2017, Campylobacter was the most commonly identified foodborne pathogen in the United States, with approximately 10,000 cases confirmed in the 10 Food Net sites performing active surveillance. For those who are not accustomed with Food Net, Food Net is the name given to the set of Sentinel surveillance sites located across the United States. Sentinel surveillance is the use of a small sample of sites to represent the whole, similar to how you might inspect the quality of a test sample of cakes before buying 1,000 cupcakes. In Europe, Campylobacter was also the leading cause of foodborne disease, with over 200,000 cases in 2013, approximately 2.5 times the number of cases of Salmonella, another common foodborne pathogen. Similarly, data from Oz FoodNet sites, another sentinel surveillance system, but now in Australia rather than in the States, have highlighted Campylobacter as the leading cause of foodborne disease, with an estimated 160 notifications per 100,000 population. Although Campylobacter enteritis generally is considered a benign self-limiting disease, as we've heard before, there is significant morbidity and mortality even in developed countries. A recent report from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimates Campylobacter infection causes 124 deaths annually in the United States. This is, of course, a much lower mortality than what's observed in developing nations. But the mortality risk from infection is highest at the extremes of age and in those who have underlying disease processes, such as things that will modify their ability to fight the infection. While these data highlight the importance of Campylobacter, it is important to underscore the fact that many epidemiological studies likely underestimate the true incidence of disease due to the surveillance methods utilized. For example, in the United States, active surveillance as part of FoodNet is established for 10 representative locations around the country, accounting for only 14% of the United States population. Despite the active nature of this surveillance, case identification is dependent on subjects seeking care, and a 2011 report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention highlighted the underreporting inherent with this type of surveillance. For Campylobacter, it was estimated that for every one case of campylobacteriosis that was clinically diagnosed, over 30 cases occurred in the community. And now for one of my favorite parts of every episode, talking about risk factors and reservoirs. So, we know that Campylobacter is one of the most likely causes of why you have diarrhea, and that Campy is also one of the leading causes of foodborne illness, but that isn't the perfect way to describe the disease. Rather, Campylobacter can be transmitted in many ways across different species that act as reservoirs, as well as environmental sources. I personally would actually add it into the foodborne, waterborne, and zoonotic disease categories, but you'll understand why after I go over the risk factors. And yes, risk factors is the fancy epidemiological terms to basically answer the question, what characteristics or activities increase my risk of contracting this disease? So let's get into it. One of the riskiest activities appears to actually be international travel, which, I mean, positive. There was definitely a reduction in cases over the last year. But when I say international travel, that is normally within the context of studies published out of the US, Canada, and Europe. Providing a deeper specificity, in a meta-analysis published in 2009, it was shown that those returning from Southeast Asia had the greatest amount of Campylobacter infection, at 32%, compared to only 8% from South Asia, 5% from Africa, and 2.5% from Latin America. While these values may not be consistent across the literature, the general order of the risk associated with travel to different regions of the world is similar. It is most likely that these are acquired through the consumption of contaminated water or meats in the country of travel. And, as I mentioned earlier, when an individual has countless challenges with the same strain of Campylobacter, they can acquire resistance. But when you travel, it's likely a new, novel one compared to what your body has already become resistant to. This is one of the main reasons why international travel is so risky. You might wonder, why would, let's say, the government of Belgium care about travel-related Campylobacter? Well, while difficult to prevent, the introduction of exotic strains of Campylobacter may potentially increase the amount of antibiotic resistance observed in domestic populations, in addition to exposing quote-unquote virgin populations that have no prior resistance to the strain, as I mentioned just before. These factors in combination can result in an increase of foodborne illness if the disease is spread through the environment and illness that is more difficult to treat, and I'll touch on antibiotic resistance in Campylobacter a little bit later. It actually is a pretty interesting topic. In addition to travel, which is quite a specific activity, Consumption of many foods and untreated water has been shown to be a significant risk factor for Campylobacter infections. Some of these main foodborne risks, using outbreaks within the United States between 2010 to 2017 as an example, identify dairy, poultry, mollusks, beef, fish, and a very large unknown or multiple foods category group as the primary risks. Diving deeper into the mechanisms of how foods become contaminated with Campylobacter, domesticated animals are well-known reservoirs of Campylobacter species. For this reason, fresh and frozen meats are frequently contaminated with Campylobacter, whereas commercial cooked products are less affected. Of all domesticated animals, though, undercooked poultry products and raw milk are widely recognized as the primary source of food-related transmission of Campylobacter species to humans. So, how is every bodybuilder's favorite food making us sick? And yes, I mean chicken. Well, a major contributing factor is that Campylobacter is a commensalistic organism, meaning that it lives in harmony in broiler chickens, aka the ones that we eat. Therefore, Campy can be found all around most poultry farms and their surrounding environments, including the soil, water source, dust, building surfaces, and the air. So I highly suggest not drinking that delicious natural spring water that is rolling out of that poultry farm. But that's just me. In addition, though, it's not just limited to chickens. It is common for commercial turkeys and ducks to also serve as reservoirs of C. jejuni and C. coli. Therefore, it's widely accepted that the presence of imported and local broiler chicken farms contributed to the overall burden of Campylobacter infections. So many that between 2001 to 2012, an estimated 71% of human campylobacteriosis cases were attributed to chickens in Switzerland. Similar numbers have been put forward by other nations, including some studies in Canada, the United States, and Britain. In addition, a very interesting study from Denmark, a finding that confirms that previously reported in the Netherlands, indicates that there may be a higher risk in organic chicken compared to conventional ones. This relative risk, i.e. if we take two identical people and feed them both the same amount of organic compared to conventional chicken, is 1.7 times higher for those who consume organic carcasses compared to conventional ones. Unpasteurized milk, the traditional kind that you squeeze out of a cow's udders, has also been implicated in a growing number of outbreaks in recent years. But how does this milk get infected? Well, most likely from one of two pathways, and yes, both are 100% gross, so look away, milk lovers. Cow's udders can obviously get dirty. They're cows, they do cow things like sit in mud and eat grass and roll around in their own poop. So if the udder isn't cleaned properly prior to being milked, you can get a nice big glass of diluted poop. I told you, this wasn't going to be nice. The other way is if the cow's udders are infected with the bacteria, known as mastitis, in which when the cow is milked, they'll release the bacteria into the final product. Pasteurization, the process of heating up a food product to less than 100 degrees to kill bacteria and extend its shelf life, is able to remove these pathogens and, well, make the milk delicious and fine and healthy and not able to make you sick. Interestingly, this has resulted in some countries, such as Canada, making it illegal to sell raw milk in order to reduce the risk of foodborne illness in the community. But sorry, vegans, in addition to consuming contaminated meat from domesticated animals and raw milk, contact with domesticated and companion animals also poses a significant risk for the transmission of Campylobacter species. This can include visiting petting zoos, having a pet animal, or providing care to animals in various settings. Starting from the farmyard, in addition to our feathered friends, pigs, cows, goats, and sheep have been associated with infection risk. The prevalence of Campylobacter in cattle varies significantly across studies, with rates ranging from 23% to close to 90%, with similarly high rates being observed in pigs. Sheep and goats have also been investigated for their rates of carriage of Campylobacter species. One study in Nigeria found that 6.8% of intestinal samples from sheep were found to be positive for C. jejunae, C. coli, or C. lari. In contrast, screening of fecal samples from 222 dairy goats on 12 farms in Spain failed to detect any Campylobacter species, which suggests that these livestock having varying amounts of Campylobacter based on environmental controls. But you may ask, what about those little fur balls we share our house with? Well, unfortunately, our lovely furry family members can also carry campy, and it's way more common than you think. Up to 58% of healthy dogs and 97% of diarrheic dogs have been determined to be positive for Campylobacter species. Interestingly, C. psalliensis appears to be one of the most common Campylobacter species colonizing dogs and cats. However, many other species have been detected in our feline and Fido friends. Other domestic animals that have been investigated as potential reservoirs of Campylobacter species include hamsters and ferrets, pet reptiles, and rabbits. But no worries. These guys have a pretty low rate of carriage of Campylobacter, and it's highly unlikely that they would be able to transmit to their owners or other humans. Heading into the wild, Campylobacter is common among various host species, including wild birds. And this is something that at one point I did this crazy deep dive into, which may have been driven by my deep desire to justify my internal hatred for Canadian geese after one attacked me while I was riding my bike a few years ago, but this is all true. Indeed, 35% of the cecal contents harvested from 445 wild ducks from Colorado tested positive for C. jejunae, with similar findings in other wild bird populations around the world. In addition, though, there's other studies that show much lower carriage rates. Therefore, this mixed evidence suggests that Campylobacter species in wild birds varies greatly dependent on both the type of birds and their geographic region. But why should we care about a Canadian geese flying around with campy in its gut? Well, a number of studies report that Campylobacter strains isolated from wild bird feces around broiler houses can be recovered from the cica of broilers in those houses. These studies provide evidence for the contribution of wild birds to Campylobacter contamination during poultry production and processing, and suggests a potential cycle of transmission which can result in human campylobacteriosis cases. So, I can just say, justified hatred. Check. A natural transition from wild birds, though, is contaminated water as a source of Campylobacter. Water is an incredibly effective vehicle of transmission for the Campylobacter species to humans and animals, and contaminated water has been responsible for a number of outbreaks in different countries. Drinking non-disinfected water, which has been called raw water, is a leading risk factor for Campylobacteriosis, and water contamination is pretty ubiquitous. Campylobacter has been isolated from various types of water sources around the world. If that's from drinking water samples in northern Greece, rivers and lakes in the Warsaw region, or private wells. This extensive water contamination has provided evidence that water is an active carrier of disease and provides support for the inclusion of swimming or other recreational activities as risk factors for Campylobacter. And yes, swimming is included in this. And when you swim, you do swallow water. And do you know how we know this for sure? Somebody studied this and wrote a paper on it. Don't you just love science? So, Dufour and colleagues in 2017 published a study examining water consumption in 549 participants while they were recreationally swimming. And on average, in just an hour of swimming, adults consumed about 32 mils, or about 2 tablespoons of water. Therefore, if we refer back to the need to only consume about 10,000 organisms to become ill, even moderately tainted water sources could easily transfer enough Campylobacter to cause illness while people are participating in recreational activities. And water isn't just a source for us, but also for our animals. Farms that utilize private water supplies as a water source for their cattle are more likely to have cattle that test positive for Campylobacter, suggesting that contaminated water can also serve as means of transmission of Campylobacter to domesticated animals. And although it's not as common, we couldn't finish off this conversation without speaking about person-to-person transmission, which can occur through fecal-oral or via fomites.
And if you don't know what fomite means, for some reason, this is my absolute favorite public health word. But a fomite is just an inanimate object that can carry an infectious disease. So, for example, the common cold is often on door handles. So the door handle would be a fomite. Fun, right? Human-to-human transmission, though, is pretty rare for Campylobacter, but definitely not in existence. And it's estimated that human-to-human transmission is accountable for about 3-4% of all cases. Now we're at that magical part of the podcast where we get into our little time machine and go back into history to learn all about where the disease came from, how it entered humans, and so on and so on. But I'm just going to apologize ahead of time. Campy has a very short and sweet history, but regardless, let's get into this. Campylobacters are unique amongst enteric pathogens, as almost a century elapsed between the first reports of the organism and the development of routine techniques for the culture of Campylobacter from stools. The first reports concerning Campylobacter on record occurred in 1886, when Theodore S. Churchich observed and described a non-culturable, spiral-shaped bacteria resembling Campylobacters that he referred to as Vibrionin in the intestinal contents of 16 of 17 children who had died of diarrheal disease. He named the disease cholera infantum. Following this initial report, there appeared a number of articles in German describing non-culturable spiral bacteria in dysenteric disease. After this, Campylobacter was identified for the very first time in another species of animals in 1906, when two British veterinarians reported the presence of a large number of peculiar organisms in the uterine mucus of pregnant sheep. The first successful culture of Campylobacter occurred only 7 years later, in 1913, when McFadden and Stockman isolated these microorganisms from aborted bovine fetuses. Following this first success, Campylobacter infection began to be more broadly recognized amongst those afflicted with diarrheal diseases. In 1938, Levy isolated Campylobacter-like organisms from the blood of 13 patients affected during a large milk-borne outbreak of diarrheal disease in the United States. Campylobacter subsequently was cultured from the blood of 3 pregnant women in France in 1947. King labeled the spiral bacteria related Vibrios because of their apparent similarity to Vibrio cholera and described them in great detail. King recognized that the organism likely was more important as the cause of diarrhea of unknown etiology than previously was recognized. Early isolates of Campylobacter were from blood and other normally sterile sites. Stool cultures were unsuccessful because of the overgrowth of coliforms. For Campylobacter to be officially identified, many advances and refinements in the methods used to culture the bacteria was necessary. Finally, the genus Campylobacter was first proposed in 1963 by Siebold and Verrin, distinguishing them from the true Vibrio species. After that, the study of Butzler et al. In 1973 raised the interest in Campylobacter by noting their high incidence in human diarrhea, with one of my favorite publications titled Campylobacter Enteritis, a New Disease, published in 1977 in the British Journal of Public Health, highlighting just how recently this infectious agent hit our radar. While Campylobacter has been known as a disease in animals since 1909, it was only generally recognized as the cause of human disease since around 1980. Therefore, while likely ancient, literature on its manifestations in humans is quite new. Because the history component of this episode was, well, lacking, I thought it would be fun to cover an unusual outbreak associated with Campylobacter that had occurred, because why not? So get ready to have a completely valid excuse as of why you do not want to do the obstacle course race with your best friend who just got fit and wants to live their best life post-COVID. So first, starting from the beginning, let's pull ourselves back to 2012. Prince William and Kate just announced they were pregnant for the first time. Channing Tatum is declared the sexiest man alive by People magazine. Barack Obama was reelected. Carly Rae Jepsen calls me maybe is blasting on the speakers. We drop down to Nellis Air Force Base, just outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, where 3 cases
of hemorrhagic diarrhea have resulted in hospitalization of 3 active duty military patients between October 10th to 12th. Upon case interview, it was identified that all had participated in, quote, a competitive muddy obstacle adventure course race, unquote, the prior weekend, quickly alerting public health. So the team at Nellis Public Health got to work and began to try to further identify cases in the community and those who had shown up in the hospital. They created a case definition, a definition of what characteristics of infection an individual has to show to be deemed a part of the outbreak, usually considering symptom onset and exposures, and began to hunt. So they hunted by reviewing emergency department logs for individuals with similar symptoms and even put out a public notification to identify cases. And their efforts paid off. An additional 19 patients who were both members of the military and civilians were identified. This meant the one race resulted in a minimum of 22 possible cases. Although potentially counterintuitive, you might be asking, but how did they get sick from doing an obstacle course? And the answer is, well, quote, documented common source outbreaks of campylobacteriosis, especially those caused by C. coli, are rare, but have been previously attributed to contact with non-chlorinated water contaminated with the feces of cattle, poultry, and swine. The race described in this report was held on a cattle ranch, and participants reported seeing cattle and swine on or near the course on race day. Or, in a less elegant manner, the participants of the race were most likely submerging themselves in water filled with cow and pig poop, and inadvertently consuming enough to make them sick. From the fact that most of these individuals were likely exceptionally healthy young individuals as well, this means they likely consumed a lot. So yes, next time your friend tries to get you to do a race, maybe just ask if they want to rub themselves in a cow porta potty instead. And on to our final section, treatment, prevention, and vaccines. In the majority of circumstances, a Campylobacter infection will resolve spontaneously after a few days with the consumption of plenty of fluids and electrolytes while the diarrhea lasts. Gatorade for the win. So, following your mom's normal advice that she gives you whenever you're sick to drink lots of water and rest would definitely be good advice. And I mean, who doesn't like some fresh homemade chicken noodle soup? But in situations of severe illness, support from our dear friend antibiotics can be incredibly helpful, with the use of azithromycin therapy being the primary antibiotic choice. Typical regimens of 500 milligrams per day for 3 days is provided for patients, but in circumstances that the individual is bacteremic, treatment may need to be extended to up to 2 weeks. Erythromycin is another classical antibiotic choice, with low resistance and safety in women who are pregnant and young children. While most cases will have no rationale for antimicrobial treatment, it should be considered in children with immunodeficiencies, in severe cases with much bloody diarrhea, and when the infection is ongoing after 1 week. And just to wrap up what I just said about treatment, if you are experiencing any diarrhea and are concerned, always go and seek medical advice from a real doctor, because I'm not one. Overall, though, it seems pretty easy, right, to get cured from Campylobacter? Well, that might just be for now. Among Campylobacter isolates from humans, the environment, and food animals, there's been an increase in the level of resistance to antibiotics. Infection with antibiotic-resistant bacteria is of large concern, as these infections are more difficult to treat, can last longer, and may result in more severe illness. Although the literature is mixed on the association of these features amongst cases of campylobacteriosis. Concerns of antibiotic resistance, though, have been growing in recent years. Using statistics from the United States as an example, between 1990 to 2017, the percent of samples with ciprofloxacin resistance has increased from 0% to 27%, a massive increase. Ciprofloxacin is one antibiotic in a class known as fluoroquinolones, separated by their ability to target two bacterial enzymes that are responsible for notching, coiling, and sealing DNA during replication. These enzymes are known as DNA gyrase and topoisomerase 4. In the situation where these essential proteins are inhibited, the bacteria can no longer divide, resulting in the death of the colony. But what is the likely cause of the sudden growth and resistance? Well, in 1995, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, also known as the FDA, approved fluoroquinolones for use in poultry flocks to control certain infections. Although this approval was withdrawn in 2005 because of evidence of its damage, this short time was not without consequence. During this period, surveillance identified a rise in antibiotic resistance amongst those hospitalized with the infection. As well, removal of the regulated use of these antibiotics also didn't solve the problem, as the antibiotic-resistant strains that were created during this period continued to multiply and survive in poultry and other fowl with similar success to susceptible Campylobacter. Therefore, to this day, we're experiencing the effects of these policies and most likely will for years to come. But why treat something when we can just completely prevent it with vaccines, right? Development of an effective vaccine for the prevention of Campylobacteriosis has been ongoing for over 20 years. But the process has been hindered by multiple factors, including the lack of a small animal model of disease, presence of LOS gangliocyte mimics that can induce autoimmune diseases, such as Guillain-Barré syndrome, the lack of understanding of C. jejuni virulence factors, and the lack of known immunological correlates of disease protection. As poultry meat is considered the major source of infection, much attention has been given to develop a vaccine that could successfully control C. jejuni colonization in chickens. One recent example published in Nature titled "Engineering the Campylobacter jejuni and glycan to create an effective chicken vaccine" by Nothaft et al. Highlights the use of a conjugate vaccine that combined the conserved N. glycan with a protein carrier, or even fused it to live E. coli lipopolysaccharides, and this was shown to result in a 10-log reduction in C. jejuni colonization and a strong antibody response in the birds. Which is pretty cool, as this vaccination strategy could be provided cheaply to large flocks of birds through oral consumption of these live carriers, making provision very, very simple and making it much more cost-effective for farmers, increasing the chance of its uptake. But we'll see how this would turn out once it's tested in larger flocks and more popular breeds of chickens. This is one of many attempts to create an effective vaccine, so it'll be interesting to see which one develops over time. But enough about chickens. What about us? Well, scientists have been working on this for years and have tried a bunch of different strategies to identify vaccine targets. This includes killed whole cell vaccines, like those that have been shown to be effective for Salmonella typhi and Vibrio cholera, and some subunits on the surface of the bacteria, such as the N. glycan, that I just mentioned seems to be working pretty well in birds, and the lipopolysaccharides of the cell wall. But thus far, all these attempts have failed, with weak immune responses observed in humans during phase 1 trials. So it really seems that at this point in time, we're going to be depending on a chicken-based vaccine to save the day. But who knows what time and more funding can bring. And now we've reached what I think is one of the most important parts of the entire episode. How can we prevent this disease from infecting us, rather than kind of trying to deal with it once it's here? The general prevention of Campylobacter infection is similar to many foodborne illnesses, and therefore is primarily out of the hands of the consumer, ourselves. At this point in time, due to the continuous transmission back and forth between wild animals, water reservoirs, humans, agriculture, and a myriad of other sources, prevention is truly key. Specifically, much of this work has focused on ensuring access to sanitized water and processes that have been integrated to reduce the farm-to-table transmission of the bacteria. When speaking about chickens specifically,
improving animal husbandry or the way that we care for animals, regulations surrounding butchering to reduce cross-contamination of meat products, and helping to improve individuals' food safety are key factors to reduce campy in the food that we eat. Which is where I'll quickly segue to a food safety minute. So, food safety, we all think we know it, but we also all learned it from a million different spots. But key messages that we should all focus on would include, first off, and always, as an overarching message from every single person who works in public health and medicine, please wash your hands, wash them frequently, use soap and water, and especially do this after handling raw and cooked foods. And don't touch your face with chicken hands. I don't think we need more don't touch your face messaging nowadays, but don't do it. I believe in you. Next, to complement the whole soap and water is fun concept, also ensure that all the surfaces, dishes, and other kitchen tools that are used are not contaminated. This includes your cutting board and your knives. Therefore, if you cut chicken up, clean up all those pieces that have touched the juice and soap and water, clean off that countertop surface, and your hands. By doing this, you will decrease your chance of contamination as much as possible. On the note of cleaning, try to use as safe of water as possible when preparing food. This means to attempt to clean cooking items and utensils with water that has been purified to ensure that you don't contaminate them prior to using them and putting them in your mouth. This can be especially important when you're camping or if you live in an environment that doesn't have access to potable water. Next, ensure your raw meat is cooked thoroughly. This one seems to be rarely hard for individuals, but most of the ways you've been taught to check if food is cooked may be wrong. Studies have shown that using the by sight method is not sufficient to identify if something is cooked or isn't cooked. So if you can, buy a food thermometer. Next, separate your raw and cooked foods. This can mean not putting cooked food back onto a plate that had raw food on it previously. I kid you not, I've seen this happen at many a BBQ. Ensuring that raw meat is stored at the bottom of your refrigerator to prevent juices from falling over onto your fresh vegetables, or using separate grocery bags that are designed for raw meat to ensure that you never put your fresh veggies in the raw meat bag that you used the week before. On that note, also try to clean your cloth bags pretty often. It's something that a lot of us forget, but it's been shown to actually be a pretty good fomite for diseases. Next, keep your raw food at cool temperatures, which would be at least 4 degrees Celsius or 4 degrees Fahrenheit, including when you're going to defrost it, which I know is a massive pain. But the longer any food is at room temperature, the faster any existing bacteria can replicate, and as always, more bacteria means a higher chance of you getting sick. This includes when you're cooking turkey. And I know that one can be a week to defrost. And finally, wash your fruits and vegetables with water. I'm leaving this one as the last one I'll touch on today, as this one doesn't have the strongest evidence behind it. Many pathogens are able to generate biofilms, which we talked about earlier, which makes washing them off basically impossible. So definitely do this, as it will reduce the total amount of bacteria that are on the food source, which can dramatically decrease both how severe your foodborne illness is, and may even protect you from illness. But really, water can only do so much without it being aggressively scrubbed, which is going to ruin a lot of your perishable foods, like lettuce. Please do not use soap, bleach, or other disinfectants on your food. You don't want that stuff in your body, and fruits and vegetables are living things that absorb what you put on them. And that's the episode! Oh my god, I just hit a wall because I was so excited for this to be done. But in conclusion, while Campylobacter is definitely not the most deadly disease you've ever heard of, it is probably one of the most likely you will encounter, no matter where you live in the world. So next time that you eat some slightly pink chicken and your stomach is gurgly for a few days, you can look down and be like, wow, Campylobacter, how cool. And maybe feel a little bit better that you at least know what's attacking you. I hope that you enjoyed this episode and learned something new today. If you did, give Infectious a follow or like, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you stream your podcasts from. As well, in exciting podcast news, I actually just finished making the website, which is infectiouscast.com, for show notes and other fun things. As well, the same handle is used for Instagram and Twitter if you want to follow those. Although, I'm not going to lie, I'm not the most active on them. I always like to finish this off with some fun facts because everyone who knows me knows that I love fun facts. So Theodore Roosevelt, yes, the guy that teddy bears are named after, who might have been the president of the United States at some point in time, had a pet hyena. His name was Bill. I couldn't make this up because why would you not name your pet hyena Bill? And Bill was actually a present from the Emperor of Ethiopia. The weirdest part, though, is Bill wasn't really an exceptional part of Roosevelt's life because apparently he filled the White House with animals, including 5 dogs, a small bear named Jonathan Edwards, fantastic name, a lizard who was also named Bill, guinea pigs named Admiral Dewey, Dr. Johnson Bishop Doan, Fighting Bob Evans, and Father O'Grady, Maud the pig, Josiah the badger, Eli Yale the blue macaw, Baron Spreckle the hen, a one-legged rooster, a barn owl, Peter the rabbit, and Algonquin the pony. So yes, if you ever thought the White House was a zoo, it definitely was in 1901. Anyways, thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And remember to try to pass on a smile today. They're contagious, but in a good way. Take care. Bye.